Welcome to Supercharge, the Change and Comms podcast. In this series, we've been exploring change management and comms across the globe. And in this episode, we're talking to Aya Ferguson. Aya spent the majority of her career working and leading change in higher education and is now the founder of Caught in the Middle, a consultancy service that sees middle managers as the VIPs of higher education. And we'll get to hear a bit more about this later in the episode. But as always, before then, over to Barcelona to say hi to Pete.
Hello. Afraid we've run out of water here, so if anyone's got any they can send our way, that would be good. We're now in extreme drought measures. Anyway, that's not the topic of the podcast, so let's swiftly move on to Aya. Hello, welcome to the podcast. Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I'm in Copenhagen and we've got plenty of water, so I could definitely send some your way. I'm Aya Ferguson. I work in higher education. And I have done for a decade or so across lots and lots of different institutions. But in my career, I guess I've sort of focused very much on change management, the people side of change, really. So I started out in management consultancy, worked for lots of government departments, and it was always on sort of transformation programs and really on the stakeholder engagement and change side of it. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning, really.
What's kept you motivated through your career? Change, I think, can be a bit of a, you know, there's not always good days, let's say. So, you know, what's kept driving you and what's kept you interested in it?
I think it is that it's about people. So you're absolutely right. I mean, I worked on a consulting firm during the sort of 2010s on lots of different government departments. And then one move, my entire CV was cancelled because coalition government came in and cancelled all the programs that I'd worked on. So, you know, the kind of transformation, it can be quite demoralizing when some of the changes that you're working on that you really believe in, because you're passionate about and you're working on the change side. And part of that is the vision and the communications and getting people on board. When those programs and then don't happen, it can be really, really demoralizing. So for me, I think it is about keeping people at the forefront. So my role, I don't think, is to go in and realize lots of benefits for organizations. That's a win-win if we do that too. But actually, the reason I get out of bed is to make it easier for the people who are impacted by change. And if that means that, I don't know, a program is capsuled, then it's part of supporting them to deal with that. If a transformation program does go ahead and they are impacted by whatever change, then it's supporting them to adapt to it. So for me, it doesn't really matter what the change is. What matters is the people who are impacted by it. And are they having a rubbish time or are they having an okay time? We spend so much time at work of our lives that actually having an okay time at work, I think, is something we all deserve. You listen to people who, or I do, I really like going to work. I really enjoy my job. But I hear quite a few friends or colleagues who are kind of like, you know, that Sunday night feeling or Monday morning feeling. I never have that. And I just think it's really unfair that people have it. I don't think we should have that. We spend so much time at work. It should be something that we don't have to be jumping for joy every single day, but you should vaguely enjoy being at work, given how much time we spend there. So I think we have a responsibility to our fellow people at work to make it an okay place to be.
You've reminded me of a conversation with my parents, because my parents would always complain about their work. And I don't think they listen to this podcast, so I can probably speak to them. And I just remember, I think I was like 14 or something, I was like, shouldn't people just enjoy their jobs? And they laughed at how naive I was, but I think they should, you know, as much as that can be our job to help people do that.
Well, it's really sad when they don't, right?
Exactly, yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we all have to be massive career, you know, really, really ambitious and career animals, but we should at least have an okay time at work.
Can you tell us a bit about Caught in the Middle then? Because I believe it is aiming to address some of that.
It is, yeah. So Caught in the Middle is my new baby. It's a pilot this year. We've just had the first cohort. So it's essentially a membership for middle managers in higher education. So I spent the last decade or so in higher education and working with hundreds of different managers. And it's based on the challenges that I've sort of observed that they face all of the time. And they are, for me, a VIP group, because actually your manager has a greater impact on your sort of mental health and well-being than your doctor. So they're really, really important. The only other person who impacts us as much as our manager is our partner. So they have a really, really key role to play in employee satisfaction, employee engagement. And I don't think that they're well equipped in most industries, but certainly in higher education. I think they are sold a bit of a dud deal. They're sort of promoted into a role and then not given the support that they need in order to be a really good manager. My aim is to really support them. And that's where they're kind of, it's a membership model. So there's a core development path with some sort of video training on key elements that I have observed that they seem to struggle with. Some of that is sort of managing yourself. So your inbox zero, you know, prioritizing all of that stuff that reduces firefighting. It's about managing your team. So how do we manage hybrid teams in this new world post-pandemic? And then it's about managing upwards. So your boss and your peers, how do we do that well? It's leading through change. It's a bit on process improvement because actually universities have a lot of really cumbersome processes. So something that will give them a few tools to reduce pain points in their sort of local processes. But really, I think the real value in it isn't that core content because you could probably Google some of that. It's about harnessing it, making it relevant for people in higher education. And then it's about connecting them so that they feel supported. So a lot of what I've witnessed in managers across lots of different institutions is that they feel isolated. They feel like they're the only people who are going through whatever they're going through, the only people who are facing those challenges and maybe not able to deal with them. They don't think anybody else has the same. And I really want to just open those horizons up so they can see that everybody else at HE and probably other industries too are facing exactly the same things, and you could reach out and actually support each other with it. So it's really about, so there's, you know, the membership has that core content. It has a LinkedIn group for people to connect with each other. It has monthly Q&As. It has new content every month, but it's really about creating a community so that they feel connected and not isolated, and they have a network of peers they can tap into for particular challenges. So I'm quite excited about it.
So one of the challenges I can recall, particularly within higher education, but not exclusive to, is that a lot of individuals who are promoted to management maybe never wanted to be managers. They never set off on their career path to do that. They're experts in their field, but the only way to seal progression or an increase in salary is to have to take on management responsibilities, and it may not be natural to them. So the gap that you've spotted and that you've responded to has to help that cohort of people. They start off their careers, they're thinking that they're going to be a researcher or a specialist in some form of academia, but by no reason other than progression is traditionally seen to be promotion, and promotion is seen to be line management. And that's the only way that they can either increase their earnings is to have to do something they may not be either wanting to do or naturally gifted at doing. So the challenges there that poses almost explains a whole load of things you just discussed and mentioned in terms of workplace issues, because they're not equipped to do it. They went to work on the Friday, applied for a job, become a manager. The Monday's come around, they've been appointed, but they've had nothing in the Saturday and the Sunday to equip them to be, you know, like you describe, as influential in your life as your partner. It's a real gap.
It's madness, right? That we don't do that, that there isn't that support, right? I mean, we all know how influential a manager can be on our own well-being. You know, I'm sure we've all had situations where there's been a bit of tension or something, and you've brooded over it. We've all experienced it. So the people that are, you know, the powers that be know this stuff because they've been there. So why aren't we doing more about it? Why aren't we supporting people? And there's lots of research. There's lots of evidence out there that shows, I think it was ProSci, so in terms of change management and managers to be good at leading their teams through change. I think they said something like 2 out of 3 or 63% of managers do not feel prepared to lead change and to lead their teams through change. That's crazy. How are we doing that? You know, there's a massive gap, I think.
We see it as well, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
When I'm doing like change things, it's the managers you speak to who are like, yep, brief my team on this. Yep, talk them through it, done a survey, know what they're doing. They all know what's going on. And then you speak to another manager who's like, oh my God, you're so busy. I have no idea. I don't have time to talk to the team. They're just going to have to deal with it. And you think, oh, okay, can we meet in the middle somewhere?
And I don't think it's malicious.
Right, there you go, caught in the middle. It's exactly right.
But it's not willful, right? It's just that nobody has given them those skills or taken the time. And also, nobody has taken away a bit of their day job, the operational stuff, to allow them the time to develop and grow as a manager. So, you know, if you're, as you said, Chris, if you're in a manager role because you didn't really want to be there, it's just that that's the next step because that's the career trajectory, are you really going to go out of your way to take the time to become a shit hot one? You know, are you going to take the time to do that course or to do that coaching or qualification or whatever it is, if nobody is sort of making you do it? It's a tough place to be.
It is, because you naturally gravitate to the things that you like doing and the things that you're good at doing. So if you are still working in the same kind of environment, but you're now a manager, my experience has been people who are probably less effective as managers, who haven't been given the skills all the time, often see the conversations that, you know, this is great, Pete, for you, because you've got two former managers on the call.
Can you bring that up?
but you know, we know how to address or when to address something. But for somebody who doesn't, they might see that as conflict. So they naturally avoid having even some of the easier conversations, because it feels like conflict, even though it's probably not. So they will naturally spend more time doing their day job or the bit that they prefer doing that they've left behind. And then the problems then manifest in terms of staff not being ready for change, staff not just generally being communicated with. That member of staff, their own career trajectory is now hampered because, you know, their immediate role model is ineffective, not necessarily through their own choice, but just through lack of skills. And I reflect back on learning and development schemes where they do leadership programs, but those people are typically cherry picked off. You know, they're the ones that being picked off and said, right, you're going to come on this scheme. We think you're ideal for this. And off you go. We're going to put you amongst a cohort of 30 people and you're our next leader. And the rest of people looking around going, you know, hold on a minute though, but I still need that stuff. But you're kind of washing your hands for me a little bit. I don't know. Oh, look, I've got a manager's job. Yeah, I'm in the gang. And like, but you never got that course.
Well, actually, the people who put themselves forward for that stuff are the ones that who probably get there on their own, right? They can go and do some other development. They will, because they are interested in learning, they know that there's a gap that they want to fill. But typically, we're not, certainly in HE, I don't think we have a culture in most organizational, most institutions where you hold up your hand and say, okay, this is a skills gap for me. I don't know how to manage. Please help me. That's a pretty brave thing to say. And most people wouldn't.
Yeah, it is, because in some ways that could be perceived as restricting, can't it? You know, someone might not want to tell you that because you might not think of me as ready for the next job.
Is it acceptable to say, I don't want to be a manager? It's not my skill set. It's not what I love doing. That will be frowned upon, right? My husband's a school teacher, secondary school teacher, and he got promoted to head of department for a few years. He hated it, realized he really did not want to be it, and demoted himself. But that was, you know, that's odd, isn't it? Why wouldn't you want a promotion? Why wouldn't you want what is perceived as a better position or promotion? It took a while for him to explain that.
Culturally, that is a shift, isn't it, in people's mindsets, that actually progression isn't just based on seniority. Your expertise and how you grow your expertise should lead to, you know, a professional development. That doesn't necessarily mean you'd be a line manager, because not everybody's going to be good at doing it, and that's okay. it might just be that you don't enjoy it, like you said, or it could be that it's just not really, you know, your personality trait to be able to do those things. We don't really cater for those people. So I guess that's where you're caught in the middle, kind of also has a second meaning, because you're trying to capture those people who want to be but don't have the skills.
And it's a tough place to be, because you've just, you know, stopped being a team member or a peer, and you're not quite a senior leader yet, and you are caught in that middle. So part of your role is still to really represent your team, and you might feel that they are best served by you being just one of them. So you're caught by what your team members want. You're caught between that and then what senior leadership are expecting you to be strategic and, you know, have a much wider horizon and an outlook. And it's a really tough place to be there in the middle, because you're one day you're dealing with your team and some really practical operational stuff. And the next you're expected to figure out how you turn the institution's vision into reality. And I mean, you know, that's hard.
I remember the first time I was a manager, someone told me, I think my manager said to me, you can't be friends with anyone in your team anymore. I thought, oh, no, that's...
And I think that's why it can be so isolating, right?
Yeah, because people never really tell you what they want to.
Yeah, and if you've left having a team that you're with and then suddenly you're their manager and you are not allowed to be friends with them anymore, which I think is a bit rubbish, actually. Yeah. But there is a little bit of a distance, right? True. So you're sat there and you don't... Then who do you turn to for support? That's why the sort of peer support network that I'm, or the community, is so important, that you can still get that so you're not feeling so isolated.
Yeah, it's a massive part of it, because Pete's right. You know, I can recall times earlier in my career where I've either moved into a new management role and I'm working with people who are my friends. I'm still their friends. It's just I can't talk to them about stuff and I can't express things how I would have done before. And so there is a shift in that space. So having that network actually is really important, because it's a safe space to go to. It's an opportunity to be able to express without...
You still need to talk about the stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like what you're doing there as well, because at the beginning you described, you know, the types of content and stuff that you deliver, but it's the context of that you never get from a LinkedIn learning course or, you know, from any kind of generic course system provider out there. You get told how to do a job, but you don't get the context of how that applies in HE. And, you know, these job adverts that pop out and say, you must have HE experience. And I go, really? And then I worked there and went, yep, okay, I can kind of see that, you know, the setup is a little bit different and the processes are a little bit different. And you're not really dealing with one customer. You've probably got six or seven, because you've got your different colleges or schools or faculties, whichever the brand of the time is, and your professional services, but even those vary, you know, through to your student community, and they're all different the challenges may be the same, but the context behind how to deal with them is massively different. And that's where you know, when you see job adverts that say, you know, must have HE experience, that's why they exist. It's because it's difficult. It's a moving landscape with a lot of different people in it. And that's, I think, again, the context of what Caught in the Middle offers is something that was eye-opening to me when I moved.
And because we want to feel understood, right? When you go in as a contractor, you often go in and they say, oh yeah, we're different. And most of the time you think, well, they're not so different because organizations are organizations, people are people. But when I started sort of thinking behind Caught in the Middle, I talked to friends who worked in government, who worked in the NHS, and they're all saying, oh, we could do with that. That'd be really good. You know, NHS managers definitely need something like this as well. And I could have gone wider, but I think in order for it really to be impactful, it's that network of people, of your peers who work in the same industry, who understand, who speak the same language, so that you really feel understood. Yes, absolutely. Other industries face the same challenges for middle managers. I think it's a problem everywhere. But I think with my sort of knowledge and experience of HE, I can really make it something that resonates with real life examples of HE, because as you say, LinkedIn Learning, typically it's American and it might be from an industry that doesn't really resonate. In order for people to listen, these people are busy, right? Middle managers are really firefighting all the time. In order for them to sit up and listen, it has to resonate with them. So it has to be specific to their situation. That's why I think actually keeping it quite narrow to just HE is really, really important.
What do you think about things like the ILM or those similar kind of like graded management schemes that people can do?
I'm all in favor of development. My challenge or the issue that I see with it is quite often we go on a generic training or access generic training and then we go back to the day job and we don't really implement it. Does it really make a difference? And you know, you might get a big consultancy in, a big learning and development consultancy in, and do a leadership program, as you mentioned, Chris, earlier. We put a whole load of people through it, and how much do they actually implement? Now, I'm not suggesting that I've got that completely sussed, but part of what I'm hoping to do with Caught in the Middle is to have monthly Q&As, have live coaching sessions, and actually also have an implementation week. So I'm currently trying to figure out which week of the year is the least busy in the HE calendar. But once we have that, it'll be about, okay, so you learned all this stuff now. Have you actually done it? Have you got your inbox to zero? Have you actually gone and started asking open questions in being a coaching manager? Have you actually scheduled in one-to-ones and done a PDR with your manager, and have you followed this structure to make sure that you communicate well with them? Have you actually looked at some of your processes and identified some waste in them? Have you know, to really sort of make it real and make it something that they use? Because I think quite often we go on these training courses and we just don't implement it.
That mentorship and the follow-up is important, right? It's having someone that you feel accountable to, that you know is going to check up on you.
Yeah, and that's that community, right? Some accountability partners, if you like, or you know, people that help you to progress with it. And actually, so again, so you're not isolated, because you go and learn something and then you sit on your own and, oh, you can't quite remember what it was and maybe I don't do anything with it. But if you have a community of people who are facing the similar things and are trying to implement the same stuff, then actually you have some accountability partners who can help you with that.
It's like Weight Watchers.
It's really interesting because you can almost do a readiness for HE course. I could just see how you can actually say, like, I'm just looking at the amount of change managers. I remember trying to hire change managers at the university was just like the biggest bugbear of my life, because we always needed them, especially when we become super trusted and able and demonstrable about what we were doing. But then trying to find good change managers, not even ones of HE experience, was really difficult. And I can clearly see through LinkedIn posts that it's been a similar vein across time. Apart from those who are either looking for, you know, their first step into HE, or those who have no experience in change management but think they know how to do it, you know, or when you get through all that noise, you know, then when they come in, you do spend time upskilling them into that context setting. And it's like, I get it. You're doing it for those middle managers to make sure they accept and prepared to deliver change well, and that they are effective in what their role is as a middle manager. But actually, I can see how you could expand that so easily into just a readiness that you're a project manager, you're going to go and work in HE. And by the way, you know, here's a couple of hours with me, and I'm just going to kind of brace yourself, people, because this is not normal.
It's funny you say that. I think that, I mean, I love HE and it's bonkers, right? And I love working for a new institution and finding out what their particular flavor of bonkers is. It's brilliant. I love it. But it's really hard. As a change manager, I think this is one of the hardest industries to work in. Like if you work in the private sector, there's much more of a culture of okay, well, this change is happening, and as we pay your paycheck, you'll just deal with it, right? Maybe not quite said as confrontationally as that, but there isn't that in HE. You have to be much more collaborative and engaging, and you know, academics, the concept of being an academic is to challenge status quo, right? So they're going to challenge when you come along and say, oh, we've had a new vision, or we have a new ERP program, or we have a new whatever it is. They're going to challenge it because that is why we hired them in the first place. So we have to expect challenge and resistance and all of those wonderful things that we like getting our hands dirty with. But it's a hard industry to be in. It's a hard sector, I think.
It's a big difference between not having shareholders, yeah, isn't it? It's one of, between having a shareholder and not having a shareholder makes a big difference to the type of way in which the organization responds to,
but also just the culture of collaboration and co-creation much more than there is in some other cultures. I mean, I recently moved to Copenhagen, and I had 10 months on a big IT transformation program in their equivalent of BT, so that the sort of telecoms industry. And that was very much we tell them. I mean, they still did ProSci and ADCAR, you know, to help people through, but it was very much a tell them and they will just get on board. There was very little acceptance that people might not. I mean, Danes are much more direct perhaps as well, a bit like the Dutch, you know. So the culture of telling people how it is much more direct here than it is in the UK perhaps. But it's quite a different, you still want to bring people with you, but they're much more sort of matter of fact and telling about it rather than co-creation.
You've reminded me, so something that came up when we were speaking to Tracy Scott last year sometime was, so her expertise is in the NHS, and she was saying how she was doing, I think it was the same transformation or change stuff that she was working on, and the same people reacted completely differently when they were in NHS mindset to how they reacted when they were in the private hospital. And so she was saying, you know, you go from NHS hospital, same people in the private hospital, and then they would do everything that you told them to do because essentially they were in it for different reasons. And I just thought, yeah, it's fascinating.
It really is.
It's interesting what you say about Denmark, though. I don't know. I always assume the Danes are so close to being English anyway.
Well, it's interesting because there is a very different model of democracy here. So that what they call the Danish model, actually, I think they call it the Scandinavian model, is that so we don't have like a minimum wage, for example, because it is an agreement between the unions and the employers. That's just that's how they go and they make an agreement on what the salary or the minimum pay is for that particular industry. And that happens every year across all different industries. So it's very much a coalition or a compromise. It's a bit like proportional representation in the government, but it is about we compromise. We speak about this, we have very frank discussions and we talk about it and we compromise. That's how you get stuff done. And I think that filters through into organizational life as well. So people are very vocal and discuss their concerns and you know, the feedback loop is constantly going. And I, you know, if that's how it is in the government and that they know they have to have a compromise. So if you consider, you know, we have, I think, 11 different parties in the parliament here and they all compromise. And at the moment, we have a government across the middle. So both sort of slightly conservative and Labour in a coalition together. And they have to agree, right? And they really stand together. Through COVID, they really did as well. They were very aligned in all of their kind of, okay, we have lockdown now, we have to do it. All the parties were really quite aligned. If you contrast that with the Commons, House of Commons, where you have people sat on opposite sides and really quite confrontational in the way that they speak to each other and just in the imagery of it, then it's no wonder that actually it might be like that in our organizations as well, that it can be quite confrontational. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but you know, it's quite interesting to see some of these sort of symbolism in society and what we might model ourselves on. The other thing that's noticeable since moving to Denmark is that, and I have always had it, is that we trust our government. Danes trust their government. There's something like, I don't know, 87% faith in the government and in the police and so on. And if you compare that to the UK at the moment, there isn't a lot of trust in the leadership. And I think that might sort of translate to organizations as well. So organizations here tend to trust the people in charge, or the people in organizations tend to you know, trust the CEO or whoever it is. Whereas certainly in HE in the UK, we see, you know, people have a mistrust of you know, whether it's the vice chancellor or it's the deans or whoever it is, you know, there is a bit of a, actually they're all in cahoots together and do they really know the best for my team and my role or my department and my students? There is I find a little bit of a sort of mistrust, which as change managers, you then have to sort of navigate around, right?
Yeah, I think I was thinking this yesterday, actually. It's often just a lack of communication. If you actually get people in the same room or on the same call, then they're okay. And you can kind of pull back the curtain a bit and reveal that there isn't, hopefully, a kind of grand plan to
massive conspiracy,
do whatever evil things they might be thinking. Yeah, maybe in a sense that's kind of reflected in nationally as well. If people just told the truth to each other, it might make things a bit easier. We're probably going on to some very difficult to solve problems at that scale. So you've worked in Denmark and you've worked in UK, and I wonder whether from middle managers that you see in Denmark, whether you see there are things that they could advise or offer, or just are there differences in the way that you see people working and bits that you spot and think, oh, if only we did that in the UK, or the other way around?
I think manager, the structures, hierarchy is a lot flatter in Denmark. So you might be a manager or a team lead, but really you just happen to have a little bit of extra responsibility. There isn't really a feeling that you are responsible for everybody in the team or that you are in some way elevated above them. So that, I think, is different to a reasonably hierarchical structure in certainly in HE in the UK. So that role of manager, it might just be you've got a few extra bits of responsibility. That it isn't a kind of, okay, well, you're the manager now, you've got to take care of all of this. They tend to give more people bits of responsibility. So you might have within a team a few people who are not the manager, but they are, you know, you're responsible for this bit for, I don't know, EDI or you are for GDPR or whatever. Yeah.
That's kind of similar. I am going at a very kind of low level of knowledge here, but that's kind of quite similar in some ways to some military roles, though, isn't it? Now, military is very hierarchical, clearly, but actually when you get down into the lower ranks, and I'm only going from some very light touch experience, but I'm pretty confident that you have an officer in charge of different things like EDI or first aid or something, but they are typically a corporal of some kind. They're not, that part of the role isn't hierarchical. It's kind of like you build out those skills at the lower level that, you know, in perhaps in a world we would see being traditionally a typical manager has all of this and you're a doer. And then you build those, you bring those together, and then you can start to see how hierarchy could appear. I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, but it does seem to, as soon as you said that, I thought, I recognize that kind of everybody has extra responsibilities at a lower level to build and exchange and then grow as you go up, as opposed to the what we started off the conversation is Friday, I'm a manager.
I haven't worked that much in Denmark, but I think the spans of control are smaller here. So you might have just a team leader with a couple of people that they lead rather than a manager that has a massive team. So they tend to sort of break it down more so that more people have that experience. And it's not such a, I don't know, overwhelming thing, because if your span of control, if you have, I don't know, you're managing 10 people, and you have to have one-to-ones with them all every week. It's a lot of people to manage, you know. So having a span of control that's just a little bit smaller makes it easier for them. And then everybody's getting involved, right?
I think it's funny, actually, when, you know, thinking, I don't manage anybody at the moment, which, thinking about when you do, it doesn't take much for one person in your team to throw your whole week out if they have a personal crisis of some kind. Chris will know what I'm talking about. I think it's that kind of thing that's almost unseen when you do make someone a manager for the first time, or that you're expecting them to step up and also be able to deal with personal stuff that maybe they'd never come across before. I definitely, back when I was a team lead, I didn't ever know anything about pregnancy or maternity and so on in my 20s, I think. You don't really get equipped for any of that stuff to have those kind of conversations.
Yeah, but even if you do, I mean, I've managed a fair few people, but during COVID, oh my God, I mean, the amount of time I spent just with people, just managing, because everybody was reacting, right? Everybody was having a really tough time. Some people lived alone. Some people didn't have a support. No, you know, there was a lot of time spent not on the work stuff, but just on making sure that people in the team were okay and were coached and supported.
Yeah.
When we set up the change management function at the university, we recruited everybody in during COVID. So we had maybe one person who was our first recruit in, and then, you know, the minute comes, we're all off and we did our recruitment through. And I can remember clearly having to not only deal with these personal issues are accruing everywhere on every day, something different for someone else. But I'd never met these people. So I was having to build those relationships with them via a screen, no different to how we are now, except nowhere near as advanced as you remember Zoom and Teams or like. And then have those conversations around, you know, their personal challenges, around what COVID was doing to them, their family, their experience, their even their work experience was rubbish, wasn't it? And yet we'd never met. And the first interaction we'd ever had was an interview. The second interaction we ever had was welcome to the team. And so anybody who would have been a new manager in that period of time for the first time, I can only imagine how difficult that must have been. It must have felt like...
And everybody was in the same situation, so they didn't get the support, right? Because the people who might be giving them the support are busy with their teams and every, you know, so they were left to sort of sink or swim, floundering, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you know, they didn't have the experience to call upon, did they? So, you know, no context in the space of what, you know, you're offering. They didn't have that stuff. It wasn't there. You found a gap.
I have found a gap, I think. But Pete, let me throw you a curveball. So Chris just said that you've got two of your previous managers on this call. So do us a favor in becoming better managers. What was brilliant that we did, and what could we do a little bit better at?
So I've got to go see you.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
Feedback is a gift.
Both just hung up. Well, I think something that both of you probably did well for me specifically is trying to keep me focused on actually doing the job at hand and not going off down several rabbit holes.
You do like a rabbit hole.
Yes, I do. And as you said, actually, some of the best advice you gave me was just stop caring so much. But whether I put that in the edit, I'm not sure. But I think I think that is quite hard though as a manager, isn't it? You know, when you've got someone in a team who's kind of interested and cares about something and really wants to pursue it, but you can see that that isn't actually a priority.
But also, how do you keep them motivated, right, then? Because you do care about it all and you want to make all the connections, and other people are not ready for you to make the connections yet. But then you don't want to pour cold water over that, because that's a brilliant skill to have. And it's a brilliant thing that we want, that kind of enthusiasm and that kind of strategic view. So that's a challenge, I think.
I don't know if it's harder when you're remote. With that lack of serendipity, there tends to be less rabbit holes to go down.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things with being remote is that we're used to seeing people, right? And we can see what they're up to. And actually, I think that's maybe the biggest disservice that all organizations have done to their managers, is not developing people in how to manage remote teams, or not developing people how to manage by output, not input. So, God, it's been years since we were in a world where you clock the hours that people are in and the input, rather, you know, we should be managing by results and outcomes that people are producing. But if you haven't taught people how to do that, you know, it's not something that just magically happens. You have to develop people. That's a skill to develop, because otherwise you just keep on doing what you've always done and micromanage and look, you know, we've all come across people who will comment on whether you are on Teams at whatever time of day, or, you know, I haven't seen you in the office, or those kinds of just micromanaging type of behaviors. It's not helpful. It's not a great way in the 21st century to manage people. But how do we empower and develop managers to not do that? Because that's all they've ever been taught, or all they've ever seen from anyone else.
Because if you were in the office and you'd left your desk and you'd gone to get a coffee and you bump into someone and you sit down, no one would ever have known, really, you know, 10 years ago that was what was happening. But now, because you've got a yellow light appearing in the corner of your Teams, everyone assumes you've gone down the co-op. Or, you know, you've gone out. I don't know what you'd be doing. I've got no experience of doing that kind of stuff. But whatever those things are that you would be doing, and it becomes very judgy, doesn't it? People are starting to make assumptions and judging about what you're doing with your time, and it's like, well, actually,
it's a real lack of trust.
That's not how it works. That micromanagement of, it is, because there's many reasons why that blooming thing goes yellow, and that could be that you're working on a different screen. But that's not what you thought when you saw it was yellow, though, was it? Now, you know full well that person who's made that comment did not think I was working on a separate screen. They thought I'd gone off and done. Yeah, so there's a real piece in there.
I remember, actually, when I first started out, way back when I started my career, I did a graduate scheme with Royal Mail, and so I had various different roles in Royal Mail as a sort of recent graduate. And some mentor had told me that I should try and be judged by output, so what I produced, rather than by how long I was in the office. So I was determined to do this. And I remember starting a new job. And this was the kind of job where most people might leave their suit jacket on the back of their chair and pop down the pub, right? So people still think they're in meetings, but actually they're in the pub, which is a, you know, We just have different ways of doing it now, right? We say, oh, do not disturb on our Teams thing instead. But I remember the first time, like in the first week in a new job, and I had finished my work. I think it was probably 4:45 or something like that. And inside I was a quivering wreck, but outward I was like, I'm going to be confident. I'm going to walk out here because actually I've done what I need to do. And I'm not going to be judged on the time I spend here, but rather on my outputs. But every time you do it with a new boss, until the, you know, you built up the trust and they know what you're like and you produce the goods, inside you're just going, oh my God, oh my, you know, I'm terrified of being judged for leaving early or going on time and not being here for that kind of presenteeism and all of that stuff that people get caught up in, that politics. But once you do it, actually people are okay with it. It's just, you know, how do you set that scene for people?
That building of the trust within in HE is really important, actually, because one of the things I was always keen on was that the team spent time with the students, not any particular group of students, but just in the student environment. So in the forum where we actually set up our place of work, or in the cafes within the different buildings, just not the pub. That's why you were yellow. But actually, because that's a very visual reminder of actually what you're doing. And it is also the one thing you've got in common with your audience. So your academics are there principally to provide a best possible service of education to the students. And professional services are there, in principle, to provide the best possible student experience whilst at university. So if you can remind yourself that your grounding is the middle and the one thing you all have in common, that actually not sitting at your desk writing out an ADCAR plan or a comms plan or a training plan or just whatever other paper the university is requiring that day, and just going actually spending some time in the environment where your principal audience is, that's a good way to show the trust in the staff.
And also just to make connections and not feel isolated and have those social connections, which make a massive difference to how we feel at work. And it makes us more productive, right? So one of the things I learned way back when when I was a consultant on a particular project, we had Cake Wednesday. And I've taken it with me to every organization I go to after that. And the concept is pretty simple. It's just you have cake on a Wednesday at cake o'clock. And the only rule is that someone brings cake and you're not allowed to talk about work, right? Because it is about connecting with your colleagues. And I remember doing this at, I think it was University of Westminster, where I was a program director for a transformation program. And I did it there because actually it had been really confrontational, the relationships between the program team and the stakeholders across the university. So when I took over, I thought, oh, that's the main challenge that we have to address. So I started doing this and would just say, oh, there's cake in the office if you want to pop by, to academics and other stakeholders who didn't really like the program. And they started to do this. But the sponsor did not value this, right? The sponsor would come in and go, oh, this is where you're slacking. This is where you're not doing any work. And I had to pull her aside and say, this is the most important work we're doing, because this is stakeholder engagement. This is the stuff that's going to oil the wheels of all the other stuff. But it took a couple of months for her to realize that suddenly all the relationships were easier and stuff, because it was just perceived as us having a bit of a natter and a piece of cake. Whereas actually, to me, it was some of the most important work I was doing.
That is a good segue, though, to our standard closing question. Certainly. Is what is your favorite type of biscuit?
I'm expecting Danish all butter cookies.
I can't believe you didn't give me a heads up on this one. This requires research and testing and all sorts. Oh my God. So I think there are a few contenders, but being Danish, I love a bit of cinnamon and cardamom, because basically there's no baking in Denmark without it. So I think it has to be like a ginger biscuit, you know, it's called the Bunake here. Brown cake, it means, but it is a snappy biscuit. You get them in IKEA, you know, the tins up at Christmas. Those ginger thins, they might be called. I do. Yeah. Do you like a jammy dodger?
I am a jammy dodger, yeah. I'm all right with jammy dodger.
That's the only fruit I'll accept in my biscuit. I consider it one of my five a day.
In the UK too long.
Oh my gosh, it's fruit.
I think you have an offshoot podcast maybe about biscuits.
Surely there's one already.
We're going to have to do it. We're going to have to do a recap, like biscuits from our guests. Yeah. Look, it's been great speaking to you. I'm so glad I've met you. Pete told me so much. I'm glad you've disproved it. So it's been wonderful to have you.
Pete, a word.
See, that still sends shivers down my spine.
Peter Word. That's brilliant. I love it when you remember that from a manager or something they'd say, and you go, oh no, Peter Word. I heard
it. It's not the same remotely, though. I remember, you know, when you are in the office with a manager and you go in and then it's like, can I just see you in the office for a minute? That does have a bit more of an impact.
Tapping on the shoulder.
Can I give you a call? Yeah, yeah. Happily, it doesn't happen as often anymore.
That's because you're awesome.
Thank you. We should wrap up, though.
Yeah, end on that.
There you are, Pete.
And yeah, I'll end
on
that.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, guys. It's been great to see you.